So it's my pleasure to be up here a second time, and this time I'm going to talk to you about the future. So it's not about the current, it's not about the business, but it is about how we invent the future. And I got to begin by saying, look, a lot of what IBM Research does is about enabling all my partners in the business, all around the business, all around the globe, to succeed in what they're doing. If I think about the morning, a number of the things that Deborah talked about are work that my team has been doing over the years. When she talked about imaging, when she talked about genomics, that's all, I'll say, the outcome of years of work that the team has done. If I fast forward to just after lunch, when Mark Foster talked about cognitive process automation, that is work that our teams have been doing together on discovering that there's this long tail of processes that companies have, and a classic way of approaching it works fine for the very high volume ones, but it doesn't really work for the long tail. And it is going to be actually what that kid said. It's about actually now going to have Watson observe processes and be able to come up with the automation that's required that enables then Mark's business to scale. And when Martin talked about the middle part of his transformation, and he called it a cognitive insights and an automation, that's work that our teams do together. When Martin's team came up with the fact that they have this decades of data on how IT systems function, what brings them down, what are the experiences on how you repair them, how do you begin to apply AI to that treasure trove of data, I'll call it, to really create something that's a fundamental differentiation for ourselves. So those are really examples of what our team does when we kind of work within the business and really help enable all of them to both improve their businesses, to actually massively differentiate their businesses. And Tom put a whole chart out there of work that we're doing together. One of the examples I will talk about a little bit on quantum computing, and you also get a chance, for those of you who walk across the pedestals, to see that, because I'll say it right now, quantum computing is sort of mind-bending. It is this thing. But hopefully, in a few sentences, you'll at least get a sense of the power of what quantum is going to do. So I'm not really going to go through everything that our team does, but if you think about it in big buckets in terms of how it really moves the needle for IBM, I think we all recognize that things like semiconductor scaling, things like what has been commonly referred to as Moore's Law, but I'll prefer to call it Dennard scaling for those who bother to read the literature, it's coming to an end. And as we come to an end, you have to reimagine how computer systems get built. You heard Tom talk about it. We talked about cognitive systems and leveraging accelerators and memory and all those things. You can talk about it using brain-inspired computing, and I'll touch on an example. Or you can imagine different than classic digital logic semiconductors with quantum, as I'll touch on. Developing core AI, we are committed that we are going to remain ahead of everybody else in both our Watson capabilities and what we'll do on core AI, and I will explain that to you in a couple of pages from here. Defining and optimizing blockchain, Bridget and our clients, both CLS and Maersk, did a great job in talking about blockchain, so that's not one that I'm going to focus on here a whole lot, just maybe a couple of snippets to talk about some of the stuff that is critical in there. And then applying all this in the context of industries back to our platform, you got to apply all this in a way that it has an impact in a given industry. Is it around drug discovery, to use another example from Deborah, or is it in the context of cybersecurity, which Mark talked about? You got to bring these technologies together and have them serve a big value is sort of the four themes of what we do. Before I get into AI and before I get into quantum, I want to touch on a couple of examples. I mean, this is a page full of many little icons, and I'm going to pick just three or four things to talk about. Right in the middle of it, you hear Watson Beat, and you heard Ginny mention Alex the Kid in the morning. And what we did there as a team is a songwriter like Alex doesn't really want us to come and propose a ditty to him. I mean, like, he can do that more creatively, better than we ever would. So that was not the goal. But what songwriters do is appeal to human emotion. And the question for him was, can you help me understand what emotion can I tap into? And what he had Watson do for him with our help is tap into all of the social buzz out there. And tapping into that social buzz, he tapped into the emotion which, by the way, when it was done in September, October, it was really an emotion of discontent that he tapped into. And he wrote a song for that. You'll see a similar theme when I talk about the trailer Morgan. So we helped that, in that case, the studio, come up with the trailer for Morgan. The insight was not about doing just computer vision and doing video. Yes, we did all those things, and those are really hard. The insight there was, a trailer again appeals to human emotion. So the question was, for science fiction movie fans, what is the emotion that you want to tap into? And what is the correct mix of emotion? Example, do you want tenderness? So you saw a child running across the scene. So Watson began to understand that a child running across the screen depicts tenderness. Or do you want what kind of music and what kind of scenario that might depict fright and suspense? And those stitching together those scenes and then understanding how people are going to react to that is the key insight in there. Why do I get into that? Because those are both examples of where AI is going to go, that as we interact more naturally with these systems, they are going to get a much better sense of how we are reacting to them, and that is going to aid in all of the natural language interactions that we have with these systems. That's a little bit bolder statement than some of the statements you've heard about current state of AI, but that's where it's headed. And a couple that I'll touch on about where computing is going. If I look at what we are doing with Lawrence Livermore Lab, as well as what we're doing with stochastic phase change neurons, it's an observation I'll make. The human brain does things and computes things at 1/1,000,000th the power of most computers today. So how do you begin to model computers based on how the brain operates to do certain tasks? And we know that for tasks like computer vision, for doing certain forms of machine learning, we can get to 1,000th that power. And using that technology which we built, we call our technology True North. Other people will think of it as sort of just brain-inspired or neuromorphic chips. Lawrence Livermore is working with us to create, I'll call it a brain-inspired computer. I'll also be clear, it's not going to be a human brain. It's going to be a brain-inspired computer. So I want to sort of position it there. And sort of when we think through all those are all examples of things we are doing that both learn from a problem of what to do, then we kind of bring it back and it'll infuse in a couple of those first examples, the Watson platform that David talked about, in another couple of examples, some of the systems that Tom's team brings to market. And then in turn, those are consumed by Martin's and Mark's team to sort of make the bridge all the way from the research we do out into the market. So touching from there, let me touch on core AI for a moment. Some of the things our team has done. We want to go digest 45 million articles. You heard Deborah talk about this 40 million articles and pieces of research in a couple of areas that her team works on. So the number 45 wasn't sort of picked in the abstract. It really was a problem that we had to go solve. And the thing is, you can't just learn it once over a year. The data keeps changing. A couple of million articles get published each year. So you have to be able to do this at scale. And you have to do this when you go across all the different topics. Topics there could be diseases, could be different topics around safety, could be all those things are sort of topics. You heard me talk about Morgan, and that is literally the first time that an AI system helped create a movie trailer. Then when we look at Watson for genomics, well, in that case, it's not just looking at literature. It changes all the time. This is a field that's alive and well. This is a field in which massive amount of literature and new protocols get put out all the time. So you have to literally learn from 10,000 new articles and details from 100 clinical trials every month in order to keep that system up to date. So when Deborah and John mentioned that both Quest and Illumina work with us, the reason is that's why. It's not just that we could build the system once. They had to see that we could keep up with all of the learning there. Speech error rates, 5.5% word error rate, which is the best published result by anybody. Why is 5% kind of a magic number? At about 95% accuracy, so right at 5%, you're better than almost all humans. A couple of us over lunch were talking, and I said, you know something? I know you guys all think that I'm going to be looking and you're thinking I'm crazy, but if you think about it, you probably make about 7 to 8% error on hearing each other. And if you think about people who are even somewhat distracted, it's way more than that. People are biased by their own biases, what they're expecting to hear. So actually at 5.5, you're better than human interaction. Same we know is true for vision, same we know is true for many other things. So this is kind of a magic number that you get to. And the last one, which is kind of recursive, is we use AI to train AI. I mean, there are hundreds, sometimes 150, 200 different machine learning models you could use to find insight from a set of data. We actually let another machine or deep learning model run all those models to figure out and tell the human, here are the one or two that are probably best suited for the task you're trying to do. I think that's incredible. This is where we take even a data scientist's hours or days worth of work and condense it down to minutes. And we know from the reaction of people that this is what we do. These are things that we have claimed, we have published, which are out there. And then there's a set of things I'm going to just tell you that they're going to happen, but I am not going to tell you how, because these are going to remain our differentiation until such time as we choose to publish them. So all machine learning and all deep learning in the end, they give you a result. They don't explain to you how they get to that result. But as we get into more and more professions and more things that involve humans, we are going to have to give you the reasoning, the evidence behind things. And so we are working on that, and you should expect to see that in our products over the next months and years. Two, when we talk about things that get written, a couple of times we saw at Woodside and at other places things got written by AI systems. Well, AI systems can be pretty good at facts, but they're not necessarily very good at persuasion. And we are going to build systems that their language is persuasive. By the way, that is when humans in their interactions begin to intuitively understand that. And we are going to go forward and do that. By the way, not just in the written word, but also in the spoken word. So computers are not going to sound robotic at some point in the future. They're going to sound much more emotive and understand the emotion of their listener and get there. By the way, that also implies if you understand the emotion of the listener, we're going to run computational neuroscience to understand what's the emotional state of the other side. By the way, that could help some of us too, not just the machine. And lastly, we're going to train a new domain in minutes. So as opposed to getting it down from months down to days today, we're going to get that down to minutes as we go forward. So just to give you a sense of the work we have done and the work we will continue to do in really core AI, in really fundamentally moving the needle forward. Talking about systems, so Tom put up a great chart that showed all the stuff we are doing. Just to put some real numbers on it, today, the fastest single processor we build can handle 2.5 billion transactions a day. By the way, we can populate our big systems with a couple of dozen of those, so you begin to get to numbers that at a system level are much bigger. Power 8, the system that's in the market, has four times more cache, memory bandwidth, and threads per core than any other system on the market. Our next generation systems are going to have 8 billion transistors. By the way, that's in about a square inch, if you want to think about that. 8 billion transistors in a square inch, operating at 5.3 gigahertz, which is a couple of gigahertz higher than probably anybody else on the market. Using things like extreme ultraviolet lithography called EUV in the industry, we believe that can lower costs by about 3x for our manufacturing partners. And a lot of work around 7 nanometers, which will be the next generation of technology. You expect to see that in a few years. That's a date that's not certain. Unlike Tom, I can't give you that it's late this year. It's not late this year. It's at some point in the future. And as we think about the things we are doing, we are going to deliver systems that will improve cost performance on AI workloads by 100x. 100x will be the cost performance improvement for AI workloads. We are going to have storage that is going to be able to do and help for the fastest cognitive data ingestion. Why? Because AI systems are constrained by the amount of data they can swallow and ingest, and that's got to be measured in the petabytes, and you've got to do it in and out quickly. And we're going to revolutionize the open interfaces that allow you to add on many other heterogeneous elements into a system. So it's not just processor and memory, but it's accelerators, it's FPGAs, it's these things called storage class memories, all of these things living as primary elements right on there. I'm going to spend my last 5 minutes just talking about quantum. And I know quantum is not going to be easy to understand, but I'm going to try to make it so. One, we put quantum out on the cloud as really a trial experience for all our, we thought the PhD level physicists and a couple of others, and we put it out last April. I was expecting that if I got a few thousand people try some things out, I would have been really, really happy. We got 275,000 experiments run over the last 9 months by people around the globe. That told us that there was a much wider appetite and a much greater and keen interest on this topic than we had expected. By the way, we do work on materials, on the fundamental devices, on how do we read and write. By the way, why I say read and write, for those who don't know, you can't really read a quantum bit, because a quantum principle states if you try to read what's in a quantum bit, you destroy it. Literally, you destroy it. So you can't really quite read from it. So you got to do all kinds of tricks about how do you read superpositions of bits and so on. By the way, a quantum bit is not really a one or zero as you think of it. A normal bit is a one or a zero, and doing things to it doesn't change it. A quantum bit lives as a superposition of the two, so you should think of it as living in a probabilistic space. And so the kind of algorithms you do now have to go improve on it dramatically. Now, the power of it, just to mention a couple of things, when you do things like sorting, or when you try to do things like look up a database, normally the amount of compute you do is proportional to the size of the database or the size of a list you're trying to sort. Quantum computers are really, really different. They do things in a square root of the size of the problem. And that's kind of the weirdness of saying, well, I can use superposition to kind of put a number of values in at the same time. So you should think of it like that. It's operating on a large set of data all at the same time because it doesn't live in any particular state at a given time. That's maybe the easiest intuition I can give you. Okay? Now to convert it to sort of more tangible material terms, that middle white, what I call easy, is what I'll say computers of today do. So do note, I'm putting the problems of the hardest supercomputer of today out there in that middle white labeled easy. Then there is the big blue that we know we'd like to go solve, but we don't know how to go solve. And I'll give you some examples in there. Quantum stretches out that white into a big portion of that blue. What are some examples in there? Medicine and materials. So machine learning, searching big data. So searching big data, as I told you, the problems take a very long time if you have a long list of data. That's a dramatic improvement using quantum. On medicine and materials, I'll touch on that example actually in the next page. On medicine and materials today, a simple molecule like caffeine, we do not understand how it works. We know empirically what it does. It wakes up certain people, it doesn't wake up certain other people, but we have no idea how it works. Why? The underlying quantum state of these things is governed by its electrons, is governed by its bonds, is governed by the different elements that are in there. Today, if the total molecule reaches something like 30 or 40 electrons, if you think back to high school chemistry, you're done. Beyond that, you cannot compute it on the world's fastest supercomputer. So quantum, a 30 or 40 qubit quantum computer can go do it. And that is going to be a huge, huge power in the entire materials world, pharma world, and so forth. So that's why I'm using that as an exemplar to really explain what quantum can do. As a simple example, and I don't expect you guys to bother to read the detail on this one, but this is where it just shows that if you try to simulate and emulate on today's computers simple molecules, in this case an example called calcium monofluoride, you're off by 50%. It's just wrong completely. These are things that a quantum computer with about 25 qubits will be able to solve completely and accurately. We know that. So this is an example of why classical systems cannot accurately solve even very small problems from the physical world. Okay? So that was just to do that. So what we have announced is that we are now putting out IBM Q, the first universal quantum computer for business and science. It includes SDKs, it includes compilers, it includes libraries, includes ways to go do this. Because of the temperature, as Ginny mentioned, 1,000 times colder than outer space. Absolute zero, by the way, for physicists is where life stops, right? All atoms stop moving, all electrons stop moving. So you cannot go colder than that. We are at 15 millikelvin, which is just 15 thousandths above that. Outer space is at 2, 3, 4 degrees Kelvin, by the way, just to give you a sense of how much hotter. I mean, outer space is just boiling compared to how these computers operate. because of that, but also because we do want to sort of provide an environment where we can keep these things up and running. We will run them as a cloud service for the clients who want to come work with us. We fully expect both labs who do physics, certain government labs, as well as certain people in both the materials industry across drugs or other materials to be those who are going to be the first most intrigued. So hopefully you got a great sense of at least what some of the future holds. You can see from my level of excitement, I'm convinced that we have some of the right technology. Some of it is truly mind-bending. I think you can accept that quantum and all is mind-bending. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my good friend, Martin Schroeder.